Good morning, everyone. We are few in numbers. Hopefully the rest of the committee will join us in very near future.
Just grew by 100%.
Our statistics are getting better. But I don't want to penalize the punctual. So we'll go ahead and begin. If you could close the doors at the there, that would help us. A lot of noise outside. It is Monday, April 25, 2005. We'll have a public hearing on House Bill 5038, which relates to the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Family. And the way I'd like to proceed would be to plan on about 3 minutes. I want to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to come forward that's come so far. I'll start off with those that have traveled more than 100 miles. There's only a few. And what I'd like to do would be to give maybe three names at once, and that way you just kind of come up, and then the first one up can start, and there'll be less time lost in travel time to and from the rostrum. Appreciate you all taking the time to come. I know that everybody's busy, and yet it's part of the process. You know, we have a prioritization process that we've followed, and we've now completed that portion, and now it's time for us to give a sense on how the citizens feel about it and about the various programs that that we're reviewing as we try and work out a fair and equitable budget based on most essential services first. So I'd like to begin by inviting up Maureen Bozeman, Terry Burchett, and Gary Hess.
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, I'd just point out there is some written testimony in front of you. The people that have submitted this testimony won't be testifying today, but they wanted you to have their written testimony.
Thank you. And if any of you have written testimony, just if you just bring it over to the side when you come up, and we'll distribute it. All right, Maureen.
Good morning. My name's Maureen Bozeman. I'm from Medford, Oregon. I am a past client of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, and I'm here to tell you what Vocational Rehabilitation Services has done for me and my life, and to encourage you to consider the budget cuts that are proposed and how devastating they would be for people that need the services. I came to Voc Rehab in 1997 after sustaining quite a serious back injury in 1996. I didn't even know that vocational rehabilitation existed, so it was very hard for me to come in and ask for help. But my prognosis for life just did not look very hopeful. My injuries to my spine were to degenerate and continue to get worse. I could no longer do the type of work I had done. Even though I have education, my age was also a factor, so some of my skills were antiquated. And I had the opportunity to sit home for quite a few months and feel sorry for myself, and it worked very well. So I came into Voc Rehab, and from the day I walked through the office, my life changed for the better. Not only was I encouraged, but they made me realize that there was life after and with a disability. The counselors were wonderful, and that they were always encouraging. I didn't know what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, because at that point I felt that I couldn't do much of anything. They also sent me to the Work Readiness Alternatives Workshop Program, affectionately known as RAW, where they continued to help me understand myself, work with myself, take control of my life. I have been gainfully employed continuously now since 2001, part-time work before that. So not only has my life changed around, I have what I consider the best job in the world, but the fact that I continue to be employed. So just in the taxes I have paid more than twofold back of what was spent for my rehabilitation process. As far as what they did for me, non-financial, I could never begin to pay back. Had it not been for the services I received at vocational rehabilitation, I really don't want to think where I would be today.
Okay.
But I'm
Thank
also,
you very much.
One more thing. I just saying that the order of selection, which is what might happen in the budget cuts, that only people with the most severe disabilities that need the help, people like myself and others would not have the opportunity to make something of their life. So thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Gary Hess. I'm 65 years old. I'm a member of the group that fell through the cracks in the educational areas. I obtained myself a welding position as a young person. At 19, I worked from then until age of 60. Just at 64, in welding, making a good living for my family. And at 64, come with a back problem that I had slipped discs, that the back was moving in directions it's not supposed to move. Required a 4 and 5 fusion in my back, and the doctors recommended that I not go back into the heavy field of work that I had been in. Come into a total area of confusion within myself and my family. How am I going to take care of the bills? How am I going to pay for my property that I'm, my home? With not anything coming in, I've been over a year now recovering from this. And in this year, contacting a friend for another reason, not asking for help or anything, just asking for notary assistance on a document. And they asked how I was doing, what I was doing, and I told them that I was wondering. I didn't know what I was going to do. And they suggested the Vogue Rehab, that her son had gone into this. He had been in a logging accident and was injured where he couldn't work. And he went into Vogue Rehab, and they helped him to become a nurse. And he's now registered RN. So I said, well, I'm going to go down and check with him and see what might happen. With my education and my abilities, possibly fourth or fifth grade reading abilities, I couldn't read documents to fill out work employments. I was in total nervousness. Going into the work readiness alternative workshop, I've been able to come to the point that now I'm here, I'm talking to people. Up before this, before I went there and got the help from the people, I couldn't have done this. I talked to my son just before I left the other day. And he said, you know, Dad, this is something I couldn't believe that you could have. This is something I didn't think that you could accomplish, Dad. I didn't think you could do it. So my children lived through this pain and agony. That the workshop can help other people. And that's what I'm here for today. Okay. They've helped me. They pushed me through. Got me education. I've got a job coming up in June that I'll be employed. So I've gotten a job that I couldn't see where it was coming from before, and all of a sudden a man walked up to me.
Mr. Hess
asked me to work for him.
Thank you. And you know what? You've set a fine example for your kids as well. Because, you know, both of you, it's been a tough time, but you haven't quit. You haven't blamed. You've worked through it. And that's a great example. Thank you very much.
That's what I want to see this so this can develop and go on to the next person who's needing the help that I've had.
Thank you.
So I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Mr. Burchett.
My name's Terry Burchett. In year 2000, I became to know the Voc Rehab program. Before that, I'm a truck driver, previous truck driver, and I own my own truck. And I was also a volunteer fireman for 17 years. And so I ended up getting what they call chronic pancreatitis. I was tube fed for over 3 years. And so when I came to Voc Rehab, they asked me what I wanted to do, you know, and stuff. And I was on heavy medication, too, and everything. And so they worked with me to help me try and figure out a new career, because obviously I wasn't going to be able to do what I was doing. And so they first suggested I went to the RAW program that they spoke of, the Work Readiness Alternative Workshop, and I got comfortable with it. I've never been one to sit around and stare at walls. I've been always active, doing something, you know, and stuff. And so I went to the RAW program and volunteered for it a while, and then I became a facilitator, and I started working with other participants, helping them use the computers and everything. And through what Voc Rehab has done, they've helped me start my own business again, but this time I'm teaching people how to run the computer, how to work on computers, and I'm doing websites and stuff. So through what RAW has done for me, I'm able to be a taxpayer and give back.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate you coming forward. And by the way, if the time frame seems a little short, it's just because we have so many people, and we'd be happy to receive more in-depth information through email or a letter if you feel like you wanted to give additional information. Next, we'll hear from Colleen Reynolds, Linda Bingerheimer. Pardon me? Okay, sorry. And Barbara McLean. All right. On deck, we have Ross Slovic, Jane Downing, and Melanie Hemming. Colleen?
So my name is Colleen Reynolds, and I'm here today to offer my support to the State Voc Rehab Program and to tell you my personal experience with Voc Rehab. 25 years ago, I was injured, and about 2 years ago, I went to Voc Rehab because I'd lost my husband and I needed to work. And I'd also met our local VR counselor at a job developers training seminar, and she encouraged me to come in, so I did. And together we decided that I should become a job developer, and that's someone that helps people with disabilities match their skills and abilities up with the employer's needs. And so that's what I do. I help other people with disabilities get jobs. Once I chose this new career, some of the things that Voc Rehab was able to do for me was they sent me for more training. And after I got that training under my belt, I was able to start working, and I purchased a brand new van. And then Voc Rehab was able to pay for the modifications on that van so that I was able to get in and out and drive it and drive myself back and forth to work and out to meet with the employers. Then we decided that I should just go ahead and start my own business. So today I call my business Turning Wheel Job Development, and I have the privilege of working with other people with disabilities and helping them to reach their full potential. Some of my favorite clients have been ones with developmental disabilities who are now out in the workforce working at or above minimum wage, living lives. They're happy. And I recently took on a client with a spinal cord injury, like myself, and we're in the process of getting her a new wheelchair and the van modifications for her as well. She already has a job lined up working at the hospital. She's going to do clerical work. And the other day she told me that she wants to be like me. And in preparing to come and talk to you today, I realized just how far I've come with my life. And I was able to do that with the help of a so I would just like to thank you for supporting this important program, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you for coming. Linda?
My name is Linda Bingenheimer. Do you want me to spell it?
Please.
B-I-N-G-E-N-H-E-I-M-E-R.
Thank you.
I have been disabled since 1998. I never thought I would be disabled and collecting Social Security before the age of 50. This was not a journey I had planned. My life had come to an abrupt stop. I had been productive and very active. I could no longer do the things I had once done. All my plans and dreams gone. Like most, I went through a depression. Being disabled plays havoc with your health, self-esteem, emotional well-being, financial status, and relationships. Because of the financial change, I came close to losing my home. In 2001, I started working as a part-time bookkeeper 8 hours a week and at a bank stuffing envelopes 1 week a month. A friend told me about vocational rehabilitation. She was a client through the Clackamas Voc Rehab Center. They sent her to a vocational training school. She received her certificate as office assistant specialist and is employed by the state of Oregon and recently promoted. I became a client of the Clackamas Voc Rehab Center. My counselor enrolled me in a Voc training school to upgrade my skills. My counselor was instrumental in getting WIA involved with my training, and they shared in my funding. In the 6 months I attended school, I was able to complete 2 of the 3 programs that they offer in the time it takes most to complete one, plus adding an additional 2 software programs to my skills. I'm sorry, I'm kind of shaky right now. 1.5 months before graduation, the school I was attending offered me a part-time teaching assistant position, and I accepted that job. I will only be able to work part-time because of my disability. There are many like me who are eager to become productive once again. There are many like me who, without the assistance and funding of Voc Rehab, could not accomplish new goals. There are many like me who are grateful that Voc Rehab is available. There are many like me who are grateful that we are able to regain our self-worth. There are many like me who can say, I can make new plans, and I can dream. Thank you.
Thank you. Barbara?
My name is Barbara McLean, and I'm a client of Clackamas County Vocational Rehabilitation Services. In 2002, I came down with multiple sclerosis. And a year ago, went through divorce after 28 years of marriage and became just like a homemaker. I had not been out in the workforce before. So it was quite a change for me. And a friend told me about the services that Voc Rehab might be able to help me. I went through Computer Skills Plus for 5 months and just recently graduated about a week and a half ago and learned all kinds of software programs, accounting clerk. And it was a little humiliating at first to be out there with not anything left after 28 years, but they were very, very good to me and encouraged me to get it back out there. And without them, I'm not sure what would have happened.
Thank you so much, all three of you, for being here. We have Roz Slavik, Jane Downing, Melanie Hemming, and on deck, Lucy, I think it's either Bakes or Baker, Julia Mesa, and actually it looks like there's 3 that want to come. Dillette Peck.
Thank you.
Okay. Fine. All right. Are you? I have Roz, Jane, and Melanie's coming next. Okay, that's fine. Go ahead.
I'm Roz. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for the opportunity to meet with you this morning. My name is Roz Slovic. I am from Eugene, Oregon, and I am the vice chair of the State Rehabilitation Council. You have some written testimony for you this morning as well. The State Rehabilitation Council, the SRC, is a governor-appointed council and federally mandated by the Federal Rehabilitation Act. The 1998 amendments to the Rehabilitation Act strengthened the role of the State Rehabilitation Council and changed its role from an advisory council to a policy partner with the Public Vocational Rehabilitation Program. Our roles and responsibilities are to work in partnership with the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services in developing all portions of the state plan and amendments, as well as policies, procedures, and reports related to the Vocational Rehabilitation Program. The Council works in partnership with the Oregon Vocational Rehabilitation Services to ensure that Oregonians with disabilities receive appropriate, timely, and effective vocational rehabilitation services, much like the people you've been hearing from this morning. The Council provides the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services with an external, consumer-oriented perspective. As policy partners, we work diligently to preserve the integrity of voc rehab program services in Oregon. It is critical at this time that every federal dollar is fully matched. The VR program enjoys a 4-to-1 match. In other words, for every state dollar, the program earns 4 federal dollars. A fully matched program will continue to allow the agency to serve individuals seeking services, including youth with disabilities exiting school. Currently, among the partnerships are school districts, the Youth Transition Program, community colleges, skills training programs, short-term programs, and many mental health programs as well. We ask you to fully support and fund the public vocational rehabilitation system as it assists many Oregonians with disabilities to become employees and employers and therefore taxpayers. It enables individuals to be independent, empowered, and contributing members of their communities. Everyone, the person with a disability, the employer, and Oregon's economy win when people with disabilities are employed. Again, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Jane.
Good morning, Chair Richardson and members of the Human Services Subcommittee. My name is Jane Downing, and I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service. We are the oldest continuous hotline for the victims of domestic and sexual violence in the state of Oregon. And I have been working with victims and survivors of domestic and sexual violence for 14 years. And I am coming today and appreciate the opportunity to speak to you about the Temporary Assistance to Domestic Violence Survivors Program. And I have provided written testimony for you also. I believe this is an incredible program that has made a huge difference for victims of domestic and sexual violence in our communities all across the state. And I would say that it's revolutionized many of the ways in which we're able to help individuals who need assistance when they are in an unsafe situation and need to flee because of that. And I want to tell you about one individual, and this is just one that represents many who have been helped from this program. About 2.5 years ago, we had a woman who came to our shelter. She fled from Washington to a shelter in Central Oregon. In Central Oregon, her husband found her and her 3 children, and so she fled to our shelter in Salem. About 2 or 3 days after she came to us, we received a call from the Kaiser Police Department. They had received a 911 cell phone call from a woman who was someone was trying to force her off the road, and she didn't understand why. And when they pulled up and pulled him over, he thought that that person was a woman, the woman who was staying in our shelter, his wife. And he told the person in his car, "I'm going to kill my wife." And when they pulled him over, he had a loaded stolen weapon, he had methamphetamines in the car, and he had our office address. He was coming to find her and kill her. Within 1 day, we were able to get that woman and her 3 children into another state through the help of TADVS. And we would not have been able to do that otherwise, because we had to get her far enough away, because her husband had said, "I will never stop. I'm going to track her down wherever she goes, and you'll never get away from me." And of all the abusers I've seen over the years, I absolutely believe that was true in this case. He would have tried to track her down no matter where she went. And through TADVS, she was able to get to another state. Now, she had a rough time at first, as you can imagine. You leave everything. You have nothing with you. And so we stayed in touch with her and her children to try to help her get acclimated to her new state. Well, we were lucky enough about a year ago to hear from her. And what she shared with us is that through the help of that program, she was able to get into the new state. The shelter there helped her to be able to make it through for a few weeks. But over time, she got a new job. She got her own place. Her children are thriving. And she wanted to get in contact with us because she wanted the people to know that had helped her that she couldn't have had the life that she has now without the help of that program and the people that were helping through it.
Thank you.
That's just one story. And I just want you to know how much I appreciate your support of the Temporary Assistance Domestic Violence Survivors Program. And I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you track that case far enough to realize to know what were the sanctions that were put on the husband after he attempted to run somebody off the road and he had a stolen gun and all of that? What happened to him?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanson, what I can tell you about him was he was held for some time in jail. He was actually deported because he was not a citizen of this country, which also was a clear indication that she was in even greater danger because he didn't care about the sanctions placed on him. He was deported. He has already come back into the country, and he's being held currently in a jail in California. And that's why she felt safe to contact us, and she was able to actually contact her family for the first time in years because it was unsafe for her to contact them before.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Julie Mesa, Diette, or Dillette, I'm not sure which pick. Cassandra Garrison.
Good morning, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. My name is Julie Massa, and I'm a public policy advocate with Oregon Food Bank. I work in our Portland Distribution Center and reside in Beaverton. In my 2 years with Oregon Food Bank, I've had the opportunity to take glimpses into the lives of many people who turn to Oregon Food Bank seeking emergency food assistance. I have a great deal of contact with hardworking people who are faced with a daily struggle of meeting their most basic needs within their extremely limited family budgets. I'm here today to ask you to neither cut nor cap the support service payments associated with temporary aid to needy families, the job retention support services. Please turn your attention to the packets we've distributed to you. They're just coming around right now. They're gray. On the right side of the packet, you'll see a sheet of vignettes, or true stories of people who have benefited from these crucial payments and as they transition off of TANF and avoid becoming part of a TANF caseload. Most importantly, these payments are directly responsible for helping families with children avoid eviction and literally prevent homelessness. I can assure you for the four stories we're sharing with you, we've personally taken hundreds of additional phone calls from families who desperately need and use these payments to maintain stable housing so that their children remain in the same schools and that the children continue to have a place called home. As I said earlier in my testimonies, families that I've spoken to use these payments to gently transition off of TANF on the path to real economic independence, to avoid becoming part of the TANF caseload, and prevent families with children from becoming homeless. In my 10 years of experience doing social work, I've seen hundreds of programs aimed at families at the point of absolute crisis, and I consider these job support service payments as a prevention program or a preventative program. It seems more effective to pursue preventative payments because sometimes a one-time payment for rental assistance or assistance with a utility that's been shut off is more important to this family and less expensive to the state overall. before they reach an absolute point of crisis and homelessness. If the goal of TANF is to make certain families are working, we need to offer them brief support as they transition so that the transition is seamless. I'll just give you a quick personal story. In October of last year, I was contacted by a woman in Malala with a three-year-old son. She'd been off of TANF for 8 months and had acquired a job she absolutely loved. She was full of pride as she told me that she had been named Employee of the Month, and with her impeccable work attendance record for 4 months, she was distressed when her car quit working, and she spent $300 for the repair. She was then just short of making her rent payment and was terrified that she and her child would be evicted. She spoke to an unsympathetic landlord who told her that there were no exceptions for late rent, and she called me to inquire about emergency food assistance. I referred her to Department of Human Services. She received the one-time payment for her rent, and I'm happy to report that she's housed and still working. We helped her retain a job and maintain family stability. Most of the time, prevention is just that simple. Please hold these programs harmless. Job retention support services are simply an ounce of prevention in maintaining family stability. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Richardson and members of the committee, my name is Diet Beck, and I'm a divorced mother living in Gresham with my two preteen-age daughters. I'm also a volunteer for the Oregon Food Bank, a community representative for Head Start, and part of the Poverty Advisory Committee. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today in support of Jobs Retention Support Services and the Temporary Aid for Domestic Violence Survivors, known as TADVS. These services have helped very many vulnerable families stabilize their monthly financial situation. I would like to share you one mother's story about a recent struggle into trying to get back on her feet. In the beginning of February, Carrie Smith called me late one evening. She explained to me that she and her 7-year-old daughter were temporarily staying at a friend's home because her abusive boyfriend, John, would not move out of her Gresham apartment. She was afraid to call the police because of the fear the boyfriend would retaliate against her. She was participating in the Jobs Plus program and had employment waiting for her on the horizon at a Clackamas business. She was extremely close to being able to provide for her family, and all she needed to do was get over this obstacle by removing her boyfriend permanently from the scene. I walked Carrie through the process of obtaining a restraining order and explained to her that she qualified for TADVS to help her with the expenses of forcing John out of her apartment. Once the restraining order went into effect, TADVS gave Carrie's landlord 2 months of rent and the funding to change the locks on her door, therefore allowing Carrie and her daughter to move back into her apartment safely. Then through Jobs Retention Support Services, Carrie was able to get a bus pass so she could travel to the Clackamas job that wanted her to employ her. I know Carrie would be here today to testify, but I'm excited to inform you that she's unable to be here today because she's been working for 4 weeks now. I feel this newfound confidence and the help of these important support programs. She is now able to provide a safe and a stable home for her daughter. I am here to urge you not to cut funding to these vital human support services. Funding will keep families who are vulnerable, such as Carrie, from either enduring domestic violence or becoming financially unstable and then homeless because the families lack the funds themselves to find and maintain employment. Let's keep stability and safety in the lives of these parents and their children. Thank you, Chair Richards and members of the committee, for your time.
Thank you. Ms. Garrison.
Good morning. My name is Cassandra Garrison. I'm the public policy manager of the Oregon Food Bank. Good morning, Chair Richardson and committee members. I'm here to ask you to support Parents as Scholars, Senate Bill 768. Before coming here this morning, signed a check for my daughter to attend a class because she's starting to take her stat test. Her excitement's grown as she's combed through college brochures, and she's really excited to take her stat test. And as she begins to graduate from high school, I'm really excited for her. She attends Benson High School, and she's a member of HOSA, the Health Occupation Students of America program there. She's studying to go into the medical field, and as I've watched her grow over the last 17 years, I never anticipated that we would ever get this far. In 1989, after devastating losses, I found myself homeless with a baby. And while I was at the shelter, the family advocates encouraged and assisted me in filling out paperwork for welfare grants, food stamps, employment and educated related daycare, Section 8 housing, WIC, and other federal and state subsidy programs. But the most important thing that those family advocates did for me was tell me to attend college. Once I moved from the shelter to my Section 8 apartment, I enrolled in PCC Sylvania, where I was awarded scholarships and child care grants. I attained an associate degree of civil engineering and worked temporarily for a city. And while I was working part-time for the city, I heard of a full-ride scholarship to attend Portland State University, where I was the second Nancy Riles Scholar. I was awarded the second Nancy Riles Scholarship ever given in the state of Oregon. I graduated in 1996 with a Bachelor of Science in Sociology with an emphasis in community development and a certificate in urban studies, and I promptly applied for the graduate program in public administration. Today I hold an MPA. I worked for the last 2 years during the college career as a work study for the City of Portland in the Bureau of Housing and Community Development, and by the time I graduated in 1996, I was employed full-time and was still taking classes in my graduate program. I was hired in 1997 at the Oregon Food Bank as a community outreach coordinator, just as federal welfare was being implemented, and between 1999 and 2000, I received an award of achievement. I'm a Lowenstein recipient for the City of Portland for my recognition in combining full employment and academic achievement. And then in 2002, I purchased my own home, a long way from a shelter. Some will say I'm an exception. I'm an overachiever with the ability to overcome the odds. But I'm not an exception. I was given an opportunity that hundreds of women on welfare today are not getting. I would like to be an example of what is possible for low-income women and welfare moms in this state. I was given this opportunity to move out of poverty and back into a productive life for myself and for my daughter. Education is the key for people to move out of poverty. Education changed the outcome of my life and the life of my daughter. It broke a poverty cycle. Education opens the doors for a better future, not just for me, but for my child and anyone given the opportunity to attend college. In 1995, I left welfare forever. No more Section 8 housing, no more food stamps, no more cash grants, no more state or federal subsidies of any kind. And today I work full-time for the Oregon Food Bank as a public policy manager. Julie's my staff person. In 1995 and 2002, I assisted low-income families to move out of poverty and off of welfare, teaching self-advocacy trainings. The state of Oregon has benefited from me never returning to public assistance. It broke a cycle of poverty and created economic stability for me. We need something positive for Oregonian families. Implementing Parents as Scholars, Senate Bill 768, can use existing federal TANF programs to improve the opportunities for those seeking financial stability. Parents as Scholars option would empower welfare recipients to earn a degree and thus achieve self-sufficiency.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Representative Hansel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cassandra, could you talk to me after the meeting? I don't want to take away from people's time testimony today. Why it is that we're having to repass 768 after it was passed last session, and why the department hasn't been able to.
I would have plenty of time to talk to you about that.
I would appreciate that very much.
Thank you for your time this morning.
Okay. Thank you,
Melanie Hemming. When did you want to speak?
I'm with the self-sufficiency program.
I don't have it listed by that, only by names.
Jessica Keating, CSN Associated, Catherine Stern.
Okay. We'll find them and come at that point. Thank you. Okay, got it. There, I see it now. Is Lucy Baker or Bakes here? Lucy, would you come forward, please? As well as Ellen Lowe and Gary Pyburn.
You notice, Mr. Chair, she's not wearing orange and black today. Because the Giants aren't doing too well.
Well,
how are those Dodgers anyway? Just a sidebar, Mr. Chair.
Lucy.
Hi, everyone. Thank you very much for allowing me to be here today. I have some written testimony that's coming around on the Oregon Business Leadership Network letterhead. It has not long, but longer testimony that I'll give to you today. And it also has a copy of the business case for inclusion of people with disabilities in the competitive workplace.
Okay, would you, I didn't know if I said your name correctly. What, would you please identify yourself? Yeah.
For the record, my name is Lucy Baker. You were pretty close. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Business Leadership Network. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today on behalf of the Vocational Rehabilitation Budget. I'm here today for the Board of Directors of the Oregon Business Leadership Network, which is a private nonprofit consortium of 35 businesses that share an interest in hiring, retaining, and recruiting people with disabilities in the competitive workplace and as consumers. Our board represents OHSU, Fred Meyer Stores, Intel, PGE, Metropolitan Group and Precision Cast Cards, which is also called PCC Structurals. Our honorary co-chairs are Dr. Peter Kohler, representing corporate leadership, and Representative Brad Avakian, a colleague on Ways and Means, for public policy leadership. We're here to talk about the Voc Rehab budget and show how important it is to businesses like us, but let me first share a bit of why Oregon business, large and small, think that way. Consider what we as business and the Oregon job force are up against. Right now, 20% of working age adults in the U.S. have a disability that is significant enough to affect their working lives. Many are surprised to know that the leading cause of workplace disability are arthritis, back trouble, and the effects of heart disease. I think that's a clear indicator that the majority of our most skilled workers are aging. It's also a byproduct, however, of working hard. Oregon business paid out $85 million in 2003 for work loss days. Those are the days that we pay to workers to stay home after getting a short or long-term disability on the job. The cost to business for every incident of that is about $3,800, and 22,000 workers were benched because of workplace injury in 2003 because of it. But at an average cost of $528 to accommodate injured workers and bring them back to work quicker, that's highly successful business strategy. But for all of these accommodation strategies in retaining the boomers, bringing back injured workers quicker, we depend on Voc Rehab's expertise to do what we need to do. And last year, for the first time, Voc Rehab's clients who are over the age of 40 topped 50%. And we know that this represents many of our most skilled workers. We need them back in the workforce, and we need VR to help business do this. The Oregon Office of Voc Rehab helps businesses and its workers find cost-effective accommodation, do on-site assessments and job coaching. And around this issue, that means as close to full funding that for Voc Rehab as we can get. Oregon's VR program is notable for its favorable match rate. It effectively leverages four federal dollars for every one of ours, as Ben mentioned earlier. And the governor's budget currently proposes to trim $2 million state dollars from the VR budget, and that would result in quite deep cuts as it's multiplied by the loss of federal match. So we encourage you to restore that gap. What I've been talking to you about is a growing trend in Oregon business, and we need to be ready for it. And the Oregon Business Leadership Network urges you to provide strong funding for the Voc Rehab budget.
Okay.
I can answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Ms. Lowe.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, legislative advocate for the Oregon Law Center. The center is very concerned about the availability, stability, funding, and quality of human service programs. The budget you have before you today raises many concerns about the capacity of CAF to provide access to responsive services. I've attached a feature article from yesterday's Oregonian about two dedicated foster parents, Mary and Ray Ashman. I've included the sidebar, which says the cost of the proposed foster care budget is a net loss of $2 million. As you read about the causes that bring the medically fragile children to the Ashman home and consider the likely future public and private costs associated with the children's care, I ask that you compute the total loss in fiscal terms and human terms, and then I ask that you look beyond this biennium. Please assume that you're going to be around to welcome the healthy outcomes from increased human investment. I've used the foster care crisis to illustrate the need for prevention and early intervention, but I could have used other indicators as well. The needs cross the cluster lines. Some are also addressed in other subcommittees. Using the foster children example, they will most likely be in need of early intervention programs. That's the Department of Ed. And also programs at OHSU and CRDC and Dornbecker. You also have budgets in housing and community services. On Wednesday, when you see what was characterized as a profit and loss statement, I ask that you look at the implications for the entire department. The children of the Ashman household are candidates for services from seniors and people with disabilities, their parents from the health services cluster, and they probably will be too. I ask that you seek strategies that will promote continuity of care for our most fragile children, adults, and families. You have heard about the importance of the job retention programs and the services in TANF. I'd like to point out that under the closed enrollment for the Oregon Health Plan, you have families now having to wait until they're 8% of the federal poverty level to access alcohol and other drug and mental health services. The area of service for child welfare that is part of the CAF cluster also raises questions. Many of the allegations surrounding this section center on suggested lack of early intervention and prevention. But the legislative assignment of responsibility and funding focuses on children who have been abused, neglected, or whose families are unable to provide for their care. If the mission is to serve the welfare of Oregon's children and their families, some reassignment of responsibility and funding may be in order. Your discussion sometimes focuses on the total number of FTE. I've used an example of of one of the contractors for the Oregon Health Plan, where they found that by adding some employees, they lowered other costs. And with lower caseloads, CAF personnel would likewise be able to be the social workers that they were trained to be. On behalf of the Oregon Law Center, I ask you to examine the consequences of all the proposed actions before you. There are legal consequences because of agreements. There are physical consequences for other public agencies and jurisdictions, as well as charitable and faith-based institutions.
Okay, thank you.
There are also consequences for Oregon's neediest children and families, and I thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pyburn.
Good morning. My name is Gary Pyburn. Honorable ladies and gentlemen of this, the great state of Oregon, I thank you for the opportunity to address you today concerning the future of the vocational rehabilitation program. Vince Lombardi once said, the quality of a person's life is in direct proportion to their commitment to excellence. The Rehabilitation Act of 1973, as amended, authorizes the allocation of federal funds to assist individuals with disabilities in preparing for and engaging gainful employment. The Voc Rehab Program provides a wide range of services and job trainings to people with disabilities who want to work. Furthermore, they assist persons served to become tax-paying citizens and to reduce their reliance on entitlement programs. To help the population of the unemployed persons with disabilities join the workforce, the state Voc Rehab agencies must provide comprehensive rehabilitation services. The Public Vocational Rehabilitation Program began in 1920 with the passage of the Smith-Fess Act. Since then, the program has continually been authorized and expanded with bipartisan support, having demonstrated a constant and impressive record of effectiveness. 9 million persons with disabilities have been assisted with acquiring employment. In recent years, more than 229,000 people with disabilities entered or returned to the labor market or became self-employed, and approximately 74% of the persons who achieved an employment outcome each year report that their own income is the primary source of support as opposed to entitlements. The vocational rehabilitation program is enabling me to improve the quality of life for thousands of people every day through the utilization of solar technology. I do not have any magic solutions to our budgetary problems. I do have at least a cautious optimism that good sense will prevail, that people who generally care about the future of our great state and this great nation will continue to lend a hand to those with the yearning desire to become productive members of society. We all want the same things: economic opportunity and a continuing improvement in our quality of life. I see a hopeful world, a world dominated by increasing demands for basic freedoms, for fundamental rights, for higher standards of human existence. The very attempt of this community to achieve some social betterment for the sake of the disabled in their midst will lift the general level of hope. And in ancient times, there was a philosopher who had many disciples. One day, a cynical young man decided to humiliate him by asking him a question he couldn't possibly answer correctly. The cynic put a recently hatched chick in the palm of his hand and asked the philosopher, in front of a large audience, whether what he had in his hand was dead or alive. His intention, if the philosopher said alive, was to crush the chick to death and show the master to be wrong. If the philosopher said dead, then he planned to let the chick live to prove the great man was wrong. In response to the question, the philosopher looked the cynic in the eyes and smiled and calmly responded, "The answer, my son, lies in your hands." Well, like the young man, the future of our nation, the future of our disabled, lies in your hands. Our actions over the next few years will determine whether the Oregon economy as we know it today will be alive and will thrive or be only a memory. We cannot solve all the problems of the world. We can, however, lend a hand to the downtrodden and misfortunate among us. To better the lives of all people through leadership and cooperation should be the common goal. It is the responsibility of those who have to assist those that comprise the ability and desire to better their lives, and in doing so, better the common good. Thank you, and God bless.
Thank you, Mr. Pyburn. And all of you for coming. And the next that we'd like to call forward would be Joseph Bongin, Diana Blank, and Rob Potter. Mr. Bongin?
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Joseph Bongin.
Bongin.
I'm here to testify about my experiences in Voc Rehab. I'm rather newly employed voc rehabilitation helped me get back to work after 5 years of unemployment. My counselors, Dan Sanders and Sherry Seitzinger, are my friends and colleagues, and they've shown me that returning to work with a disability is far from impossible, and that even though you, with a disability, you can't be like everyone else, you can have many things in common with your peers, especially most of those that, you know, work for a living and things like that. Voc rehabilitation and my counselors, Danny Sanders and Sherry Seitzinger, took it upon themselves to speed up my rehabilitation so that I got a job quickly. They told me that often it takes a very long time to get a job through voc rehab, but I was placed in employment rather soon. The company I work for is Wellsprings. It's a certified rehabilitation facility. It's a division of Cascadia. They asked me to come to voc rehab, and I didn't change my, you know, idea of what I wanted to do. I just focused on this one thing, and I think when my counselor saw that I was serious, they said, yeah, he's ready to work, and that's all I wanted to do. So they sent me to work. It's been a great experience, and I intend to keep my job, and I hope that you'll taking into consideration everyone's testimony today, and believe us when we say that voc rehab is important to people with disabilities.
Okay. Thank you very much. Diana.
My name is Diana Blank, and I'm here to testify for voc rehab. I came to voc rehab in October 2000 via a program called ETBS, which is Employment Training and Business Services. At the time, I'd been working for Albertsons as department manager for over 8 years. I had become very ill and was in constant pain. I was diagnosed with chronic fatigue brought on by fibromyalgia. And fibromyalgia is a type of arthritis that involves chronic pain in the muscles, joints, and connective tissues, and is considered as an invisible disability. At VR, I was assigned a wonderful counselor. She sent me to their job search club and support club and also qualified me for what's called the hire list, which stands for hiring individuals ready for employment. The hire is a state system designed to help individuals with disabilities become employed with state government jobs, and a person can only be referred by a VR counselor or the OCB, which is the Oregon Commission for the Blind. Another program that Teresa helped me with was money for reimbursement for gas to search for work. Within a few short months, I got another job as an assistant manager at Texaco. I thought as a management position, I would be doing more paperwork and less on my feet, and I was wrong. I served as a reliable fill-in for the ones that didn't show up for work, sometimes working for 2 to 3 weeks straight and 17-hour shifts. One day, my counselor showed up at my work for a follow-up visit and to see how I was doing. And she noticed that the shoes that I were wearing were not appropriate for this type of work, so she issued a voucher for the shoes, and that really helped. But after 9 months of working there, my condition continually became worse, and I knew that I would not be able to continue with this job. I came back to ETBS and voc rehab in 2002. They sent me to the Employment Department for the on-the-job training and their one-stop career center. ETBS and voc rehab shared the job costing to pay for my wages. At this time, I was also raising my granddaughter and could not afford to pay for child care. So Voc Rehab paid for the co-payment so I continue to work and gain the necessary skills to change careers. After 3 months, the employment department picked me up on a temporary hire for 6 months, and thereafter as a limited duration for another 17 months. During that time, my car broke down, and Voc Rehab once again helped me pay to have that fixed. In November 2003, I had to have surgery for an anterior fusion on my C5, C6 levels on my neck. When I returned to work, the employment department was unable to provide me with a chair that would support my neck and head. They didn't have the funds, and they also noted that if Voc Rehab had paid for it, the chair could go with me in case I was laid off. After 2 years, my job ended with the employment department because of budget cuts and restructure within the employment department. I'm now back with Voc Rehab, working on trying to find another suitable job that I can do. Teresa, my counselor, has put me back on the hire list for Office Specialist 1 and 2, BES 1 and 2, Public Service Rep, and Human Service Specialist 1, 2, and 3. Hopefully, I'm going to be getting a call pretty soon. There are a few other things that Voc Rehab has helped me with. They paid for an office visit with my doctor once and medication until my insurance kicked in. They've assisted me in buying business clothes for interviews and gave me a whole new set of skills by putting me with the employment department. Unfortunately, I can no longer access the services of ETBS. They lost their funding, and after years of service of helping countless numbers of people, they had to close their doors. I only know of a few other organizations that can help people with disabilities find employment, and most of them are staffing agents. None are equal to or can come close to offering the services that Voc Rehab can. They are unable to provide and pay for such things as schooling, courses, upgrading skills, clothing, daycare. They cannot access the hire list like Voc Rehab can. These counselors in the program are truly in a class of its own. The counselors put 110% in helping the disabled. They help remove barriers to employment. And I'd like to thank each and every one for their outstanding efforts. So before you cut the budget, please think twice. If you cut in the budget, you're cutting our chances to be a productive citizen. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Potter.
Good morning, Chairman Richardson and committee members. My name is Rob Potter. I'm the chair of the Family Service Review Commission. That's a legislatively mandated commission. I occupy a business representative spot on that commission. I work for Portland General Electric. Thank you for this opportunity to comment on the budget process for children, adults, and families. The Family Service Review Commission spends most of its time advising DHS on TANF program, which includes food stamps and OHP. Children and families have been our main focus. As we've just been through a review process of the department proposed rule changes for TANF job support services, we are very aware of how important these support service payments are for families in crisis, particularly for at-risk families and those in transition from TANF to employment. We ask that the committee preserve, protect, and potentially enhance job support service payments budget, particularly for at-risk families. This budget item was reduced by $4.5 million in the governor's recommended budget, and I'm not sure that it's been restored at this point. That reduction would be on top of the elimination of the TANF emergency assistance for families in the last legislative session. I guess we're looking at an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure from a budgeting standpoint. If we can help parents up front in their economic struggle, we'll have much more success moving them forward to self-sufficiency than if we wait until they've hit rock bottom and by then be self-medicating with drugs and alcohol or involved in crime that cause their children to be removed from their care. We also strongly support two DHS policy packages, number 16, which is to decrease the amount of parent copay for employment-related daycare services and increase the income limit for these parents to 185% of the federal poverty level. We also support package 18, which is increase the family TANF grant payment by approximately $14 per month. Both of these policy option packages would benefit children as well as their families to better stabilize and reenter the workforce. We encourage the committee to work with DHS to implement Parents of Scholars. I think you've heard some of that a little earlier. In summary, we ask the Ways and Means Committee to consider how money is spent on vulnerable families. We ask more money be budgeted for front-end prevention services, such as job support service payments, we've heard about that, emergency assistance, emergency-related daycare, and more options for education and training. We're putting more and more dollars in the back end of the problem. Smart budgeting requires investing money in services aimed at mitigating problems as they emerge. As I said initially, an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. So we're asking Ways and Means Committee to reserve resources for vulnerable families, make sure we're investing those resources where they will have the most long-term impact. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank all three of you.
Thank you.
Catherine Bullion.
One quick question. Mr. Potter, did the Family Services Review Commission have an opportunity to discuss why it's taken so long to implement scholars, Parents of Scholars?
It sounds like you're going to hear some information from the Oregon Food Bank on that. So I'll leave it to them.
But did the commission have an opportunity to discuss that issue?
We discussed it. We're, I guess, not entirely clear of why that hasn't moved forward, but we're supporting the Senate bill, is it 768, to make some changes there.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Baker? Okay. I'll tell you what. While we get an answer on that, some input from Sheila Baker, if we could have Catherine Voley, Greg Wolf, and Jim Reuter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I don't have the complete answer, but I believe part of the answer is that the statute last time was tied to DHS getting a waiver to do that program to be able to use TANF funds for it. And because TANF still hasn't been reauthorized, it's and our waiver has expired, we are still not clear that we can use TANF funds for that program, which would mean that they would have to use general funds to support it.
Okay, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Catherine, you want to go ahead and start?
Thank you. My name is Catherine Voley, and the reason I'm here today is to offer my support to the State of Oregon Rehabilitation System and to tell you my personal story. I came to vocational rehab in the fall of 2003 after being injured in a traumatic car accident in April of 2001. A driver with minimal insurance ran a red light and totaled my car, badly injuring my arms, my back, and my neck, and my leg. Due to the seriousness of the accident, I was unable to continue with my manufacturing business. My customers, I designed and manufactured alternative interactive play therapy toys. My customers were hospitals, play therapists, grieving centers at like the Dougie Center, and my toys were actually distributed worldwide. My arms and hands were injured, and I no longer have the strength to grasp or sit at a sewing machine. I can no longer sit for hours at a time sewing or stand and cut out fabric for extended periods of time. My physical disabilities will always be with me. I have learned how to conserve energy and do what I can with what I have. I found vocational rehabilitation when I was at the very bottom of my resources, emotional, financial, and physical. I felt useless and helpless. I had all but given up on ever having any kind of purpose in my life again. Without vocational rehabilitation, the encouragement and belief in my potential as a business person, my life would not be successful today. I would still be feeling sorry for myself and not moving forward with my life, thinking I would never have a life again. My counselor, Georgia Isaiah, was instrumental in guiding me in career management to help me change from using my hands to using my brain and the collective knowledge I had accumulated over my 35 years in various businesses. With her support, understanding, and encouragement, I was able to redefine who I was and focus on opening a business as a consultant. The business uses my talents, although some days it is still physically challenging. My business is successful, and thanks to vocational rehabilitation, I am self-supporting, confident, and happy. I cannot emphasize enough the change vocational rehabilitation had on my life. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, and I would be more than happy to answer questions that you might have.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi. Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. As you can tell, I'm more than a little nervous.
It's all right. Relax.
I'm representing my company.
Your name, please?
Oh, my name is Jim Reuter, and I'm from Tigard, Oregon. I'm representing my company, Reuters Northwest Laboratory and Community Human Services Folk Rehab, and my rehabilitation counselor, George Isaiah. I'm disabled with the onset of a genetic disease called Huntington's disease. I also suffer from rheumatoid arthritis and alcoholism, which is under control. I'm on a fixed income of SDI only, and as my failing health found me going from company to company, and when I did have to stop working, I did not have qualify for long-term disability benefits. My life was a pretty dismal place until I began to do my laboratory work, which is cutting and polishing rocks, on a small scale, and I found this was something I could still do and do well. I reached a point where I felt I could sell my product if I had the proper equipment, I had no way of paying for this equipment. I was made aware of Oregon Department of Human Service Voc Rehab by the Social Security Back to Work program. I went to the Voc Rehab with very little hope. And then I met my counselor, Georgia Isaiah, and with the Washington County office. Ms. Isaiah took the time to talk to me and find out what I was capable of, both mentally and physically. Georgia also wanted to know that my business idea was feasible and that it was a good investment of taxpayers' dollars. To do this, she called on Catherine Vole, a Vole consultant, to see if I had a viable product and a marketing plan. In the end, and only with their help, I did. It's almost impossible to tell you the impact this opportunity has had on me, both physically and mentally. My mental and physical health has improved dramatically. Even though my future outlook is grim, health outlook is grim, I still look forward to getting up each and every day. I would like to end by saying thank you to you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, and thank you to the Oregon taxpayers for the help and trust in me. And I hope I will be back paying taxes very soon.
Well, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
You're a courageous man. Mr. Wolf.
I'm Greg Wolf from Oregon. I'm the one that got a job at the Oregon Food Center at QFC. I've been through what we had before. I know Jeff Green back then. And I went through other scenes before that. So, you guys have any questions, let me know.
Okay. Where are you working right now, you say?
QSC, I'm at the name of Boulevard.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you for coming in.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We have Jessica Stevens, Gina Santa Cruz, Catherine Stern, and Melanie Hamming.
Good morning, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Stevens. I'm with SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union, and I'm also one of the co-chairs of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon, or HISCO. Excuse me. SEIU represents the frontline employees for the Department of Human Services, and most of those are in the Children and Families cluster. And HISCO is a coalition of a broad group of advocacy organizations for human services here in Oregon. First, we want to thank the committee for its leadership in opposing the governor's recommendation to cut services for grandparents taking care of poor children, employment-related daycare, some of the system of care flex funds, the special rates for foster care parents, and some of the frontline worker eliminations proposed, and also some of the vocational rehab funding. We appreciate your recognition of the depth of the value of these programs for Oregon families. The core programs that are at stake today are some of the best tools that Oregon has to preserve families. Vocational rehab, jobs programs, food stamps, employment-related daycare, and temporary assistance to needy families enable parents a little helping hand when they have nowhere else to turn. By providing this temporary support, Oregon fulfills its responsibility to making sure all Oregon families have a fair and fighting chance to remain or become productive taxpayers and give back to our communities and our economy. And to make sure that these services are provided with the most efficient and effective ways, we must recruit and retain innovative and dedicated employees. Our union members, the frontline employees, continue to do the most with the least. Employees build critical relationships with clients and determine the best way to serve families under policy guidelines and within available resources. Under the co-chair's proposed budgets, there are still over 100 children and family frontline positions up for elimination. We shouldn't sacrifice the most important tools in our work to preserve the Oregon family. Parents themselves, scout leaders, church members, community volunteers, our neighbors, these are the real people who provide services in the Department of Human Services. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Richardson and members of the committee, my name is Melanie Hemming. I have worked for the state of Oregon in the what used to be Adult and Family Services since 1996, and I am still with what is now CAF Self-Sufficiency Programs. I am frontline. I often joke that I need combat pay, and so do my coworkers. There is a lot of turnover in the front lines where the, you know, where the first contact with people that come in, they come in often to the office I work at, which is the one on Wainema on Lancaster because it's on a bus line. The people who come from that area often do not have very good resources. They come from what we might call the poorer side of town. And we are overworked there because people come through the door. We may ship their cases off to another office soon, but we are the first contact. We listen to their stories. I have never been on assistance, but it's not for lack of applying. I'm just stubborn and I keep going. A lot of the people that you've heard from are, you know, have a lot of resistance, a lot of stubbornness, whatever it takes to keep going without the resources. And there are people, and I know because I am married to one who has a mental disability, who has been in the system. I finally got him on disability, single dad with a child, had to suffer through all the things of what's wrong with you, you're a white male, you know, why can't you work? We have, as a support staff, give out the resources. We see people come through again when they fall through the cracks. A lot of these people who fall through the cracks, it is not their fault. They might have a mental disability. It might be something they were born with, as in the case of my husband, and lack of support when he was young. Maybe they had something going on. They self-medicated with alcohol or drugs, and now they're brain damaged. We cannot hold them, you know, responsible and say, we're not going to help you because of that. We need services. We need all these services for people to pull themselves up with. And that's basically what is proposed to being cut. Where are these people going to go? Maybe I ran across a young man on the street the other day, just yesterday while I was shopping, and I could just tell by looking at him that he wasn't all there. I don't know if it was drugs. I don't know if he was born that way. But he needs the services. And I don't want to see him going through the system again and again and rubber stamped, you know, okay, we gave you the food stamps, why couldn't you pull yourself together? The jobs trainings, the able-bodied adults, I have seen people in those programs. At the front desk where you rarely have time to go to the restroom when you need to get your break when you really need it. You know, you always get lunch, but maybe not when you need it. We really, really take the brunt of a lot of what comes through, and most of us do care, and we'll put in that extra effort. However, when the price freeze came, the wage freeze, the hiring freeze, and we went from 13 support staff to 6,
We started to get sick. I had my round, too. I got a virus, and I was out for 3 weeks, and I was very upset because the clients were suffering. They were not getting the referrals they needed. There was not the support staff to help them fill out their applications, give them updated resource forms. It happened to all of us. So when we had 6 instead of 13, sometimes we were down to 4. It really, really affects our lives when we are trying to help from the front lines the people, refer them to the resources, get them in to see a worker, get what they need. And I would just like to suggest that if these services are reduced or even eliminated, we are not serving the children, especially of our community. People come in for the services to give their children an example of what can be done. And if their children don't see that, then they will not have those skills to be stubborn. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Richardson and the committee members. I'm Catherine Stearns, and I'm here as a proud member of Service Employees International Union, advocating for low-income Oregonians and the frontline workers in the CAF programs that help these Oregonians. In my 16 years with the Department of Human Services, I've worked mostly as an eligibility case manager, specializing in the harder-to-serve caseloads. Harder-to-serve usually implies multiple barriers within the family that keep them from being self-sufficient. I now work as a hearing representative and mostly mediate resolutions to client disputes when benefits are denied, reduced, or closed, such as those folks who lost their Oregon Health Plan benefits. Most frontline jobs and self-sufficiency programs are stressful as we routinely deal with the pain and tears that tragedy, domestic violence, substance abuse, and unemployment bring. As an eligibility worker, we often hear clients say, "I don't want to be here asking for help." We reassure them that they will be working taxpayers again. Frontline workers not only administer the benefit programs, but they're the cheerleaders and the coaches for parents struggling to get on their feet. Frontline workers are often the people who perform miracles in getting other community resources to aid a family, as welfare benefits are never enough. How many parents of 2 children do you know would sign up for living on $503 a month? Daily, frontline workers face piles of paperwork that never shrinks and represents the very real needs of these low-income Oregonians. Many of my coworkers are working sometimes more than one job in order to make their ends meet, just like our clients are. Frontline workers have low input into process and procedures, but we have seen that sufficient resources in Department of Human Services programs does translate into more line staff. And when we have more line staff, we have improved services, both in volume of work and the accuracy of work as the food stamp error rate has gone down. You can see that when you focus on it and bring people to the problem. And it also lessens the stress on the workers, meaning there's more quality customer service in the services we deliver. The joy in our work comes when the client family succeeds in achieving self-sufficiency, such as when working with child welfare programs, a young parent enters substance abuse treatment as their jobs plan, and while an ongoing treatment program receives mental health counseling and job preparation services and supportive services. They do reunite with their children, they do get jobs, and they do become taxpayers. But they do need the consistent support of frontline workers and the supportive services of Department of Human Services programs. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Richardson. My name is Gina Santacroce, and thank you for the members of the committee for having me here today and the opportunity to speak to you. Gina Santacroce. I work for DHS Self-Sufficiency. I'm a Human Service Specialist 3, and I work in at the Portland Metro Processing Center in downtown Portland. I'm here today because of the concern around budget cuts centered around the reduction for self-sufficiency workers. Our caseload ratio at our processing center is 500 cases to 1 worker. Caseloads at full-service branches are approximately 250 to 300 cases to 1 full-time worker. The caseloads for food stamps are going up instead of down. The numbers that are forecast per ratio do not give bearing to the human element and client customer service that we all are in this business to provide. For example, at the place I work,
We get 18,000 calls per month, 1,800 applications estimate per month, and a humongous amount of changes each day for cases. We also deal with Medicare assistant programs and Oregon Health Plan that are now transferred to full-service branches and processing centers. In our phone calls that we receive, we often deal with desperate clients, single parents, and families that have zero income and owe rent and face eviction notices. We are counselors and are not trained in the field of crisis intervention, even though we want that. We care so much about our clients, and we listen to people that threaten suicide on the phone, especially when the Oregon Health Plan was reduced. This affects us daily with our caseload ratios and the quality of services that we provide to our clients. We often refer to our community partners who have also have zero funding and creates a cyclical effect because they end up coming back to food stamps and state assistance. I also wanted to mention that we have antiquated systems that have been in place since 1979. We have systems that do not speak to each other, creating duplicate work, errors, and mounds of paperwork. It increases our food stamp error rate, which in turn fines from the federal government. Our food stamp error rate is in jeopardy every fiscal year because our frontline workers have little input in the policy-making decisions. If we are to be good stewards of the state of Oregon and fully utilize DHS's mission of statement to keep people independent, healthy, and safe, in our continuing to fight to reduce hunger in Oregon, it is essential to give frontline workers the essential tools, staff, to provide these quality services.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you all for coming forward. We have Desiree Bramble. I have a hard time reading some of the right. Desiree Bramble or Bramblick, or I'm not sure. Donna Llewellyn. Bobby Joe Sanders. And let's see. On deck is Robin, and I can't read it, it's Chrism or something like this, Executive Director of Children First Oregon, Sherry Lynn, and Patty, maybe Whitney Wise. Okay, so let's begin.
Hey, I'll start. I'm Bobby Jo Sanders, and I'm a family child home child care provider here in Salem. And I just wanted to speak on the issue of employment-related daycare and tell you how important it is for our children to receive quality care. And in that means we work with a lot of children that go through DHS that receive subsidies. And we are paid very minimal for the work that we do. And I know that in West Salem, I'm one of the only, one of the only providers that accepts DHS payments. And these kids are constantly falling through the cracks and not learning what they need to learn before going into preschool and or kindergarten. And so I've developed a preschool program to help those children not fall through the cracks in school. But I am not reimbursed for any of that. I am paid $1.77 an hour per child. And I can only take five children because I have one of my own that is under six. So I make minimal amount for the time and the investment I put into these children's lives. And each and every day they come with issues because their parents are low income. You know, very traumatic things, like fathers being put in jail or moms not being able to put food on the table because they have to pay high copays. Sometimes those copays range in from $100 to $339. And for a single mom who's taking care of two children and paying rent and paying all the utilities and only gets help through food stamps and child care costs, that's a lot of money that she's paying me. And I feel guilty even taking that because those children are going without while she's paying me. They're going without food. They're going out without clothes that fit them, going without shoes. We've had to buy shoes for these children. And these kids, when they get to school, again, they fall through the cracks because there's no one to teach them their ABCs or their 1-2-3s. So we've implemented a program in my child care to actually teach them to read and to actually do addition and subtraction before they go into school, because if they don't learn the basics, they're going to fall through the cracks and they're never, ever going to break the cycle of poverty. And I have a very good friend in Bend who, you have her testimony before you. And again, she goes through the same thing. She actually puts kids on a scholarship program that she only takes what DHS provides for her. And she takes a cut in pay because these kids matter to her also.
Thank you very much. You're an exemplary provider. Thank you.
My name is Donna Welling. Thank you, Chairman Richardson and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify before you. I'm here today representing the Parent Voice Project for Child Care. As a parent of two children, one of which has special needs, I know firsthand the importance of quality, affordable child care. As not only a past parent but also a consultant for Head Start, whose families are the poorest of the poor, I have had the privilege of meeting some truly amazing and inspirational parents. Many of these parents have come from families who have experienced generational poverty. Like their parents, have relied on social service programs to meet their very basic needs for survival. Many of them have not been able to break the cycle as of yet, but some, with the help of programs like employment-related daycare, have. I've watched single parents whose own parents are still relying on HUD and other programs break the cycle of generational poverty with the help of VRDC. These parents would not have been able to look for work or retain gainful employment without the support and help of TANF and ERDC programs. Once employed, ERDC has enabled these parents to provide or to be able to afford quality child care while they worked. The subsidy has encouraged providers to continue to provide care as they are receiving a steady income, although it's not quite enough, as you've heard. Without the affordable and reliable child care, these parents would be forced to stay at home to care for their children and continue their lives within the cycle of generational poverty. Some of these parents have been able to gain valuable work experience while receiving ERDC benefits, which has allowed them to obtain employment with an employer providing a living wage and even medical benefits. They no longer require ERDC benefits and have, after a long and hard road, broken the cycle of generational poverty and now are, you know, taxpayers who are valuable members of the society who pay taxes and give back to the program. That's why ERDC is important to all Oregonians. It gives families the opportunity to live up to their full potential and become not only someone they can feel good about being, but someone whom their children can be proud of and look up to. And as an advocate for families and as a parent, I know that I do. So as you consider Oregon's budget for the next biennium, I urge you to think of these families and the opportunities that ERDC and programs like that provide. Restoring funding to ERDC's budget is a significant support to allow families the opportunity to break the cycle of generational poverty. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Hello.
My name is Desiree Brublitz. I am also a family child care provider. I am here to address the issue of ERDC program. For someone who could not be here today. I'm a family child care provider. I care for the children of my daughter, who is in ERDC program. As a family member, I provide a stable environment for my grandchildren. My daughter is a single parent. She works 77 hours a week. Therefore, I care for her children over the 200 hours allotted by DHS per month. As a child care provider, I feel we provide a very valuable service, be it a family member like myself or an outside provider. Without family child care, parents like my daughter would not have the opportunity to work and attempt to make a decent living. We need to protect the ERDC budget so that working families may continue to gain their independence from the system and be successful contributing members of our society. Please continue to provide the funding necessary to help families so that adequate care and stability meets the needs of our children and grandchildren. If you fail these families and their children, you are letting our future slip through the cracks. Our children need our help because they cannot do it themselves. Again, I ask you, please do not decrease the funding to the ERDC program. Thank you.
Thank you. Robin Christian, Sherry Lynn, Patty, Whitney Wise, I think it is. You're first. You can begin.
Thank you, Chairman Richardson and the rest of the committee. My name is Cherie Lynn, and I'm here today to represent Voc Rehab and also Independent Living Resources. I was born with a congenital nystagmus, which is a low vision impairment I've had all my life. And might get a little emotional. I think I'm just going to read this. This is easier. Sorry.
Okay.
Can I let somebody go first? Thanks.
Good morning, Chairman Richardson and committee members. I'm Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and I'm here today to talk to you about job retention support services, emergency assistance, and food stamp staff positions, and urge you to restore funding for all these three critical needs. Before the state budget cuts were made in 2001 and 2003, there were funds at the Department of Human Services for emergency assistance and job retention services at a much higher level than there are today. And as you've heard, these help support many of the families who run into one-time expenses like a car breaking down or a medical expense, and they just don't have the savings to cover it. What has happened since that time, since those funds have dried up significantly, is that many of these families have had to turn to payday loan operations for those one-time expenses. And because the payday loan operations tend to be the only option for these families now that the funds have dried up in the Department of Human Services, payday lenders can charge whatever the market will bear, basically, even if the rates are very unfair to struggling families. And this has placed those families who were helped by DHS in the past in very untenable situations. They're having to choose between feeding their families or paying exorbitant rates to the payday lenders. And in case you're not familiar with these loans, they charge anywhere from 365 to 600% interest on a short-term loan. Restoration of the funds for job retention support services and emergency assistance would help many of the families stay out of this downward spiral into debt and homelessness. On another important matter, I'm sure you've heard that Oregon's hunger ranking has dropped from number 2 to number 8. We still have a ways to go, but this has largely been attributed to the increase in the use of food stamps in our state. We've increased food stamps by over 70% in the last 4 years. However, again, because of the budget cut, staffing has not kept up. And you heard from a couple of the employees, too, how difficult that is as their caseloads rise and the stress rise for them on trying to serve all of those people. Here in the state of Oregon, we still have another 300,000-plus people who are not on food stamps who qualify. And we're doing everything we can at the task force to help make sure those families know they qualify and get onto the program, because it's very successful in making sure their families don't go hungry. But with the lack of staff at the state level, they're having to wait long periods to get their food stamps, and it's very difficult for the staff people in the department to meet all of their needs. So we're very much encouraging you to at least keep the staff positions that were added in the last biennium, not cut those, and if possible, add additional staff. Again, it's that, putting that ounce of prevention there really helps against later tragedies and bigger tragedies that cost so much more money. So we hope that you will take those into consideration. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robin Christian. I'm the Executive Director of Children First for Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity today to testify on the importance of the employment-related daycare program. Children First for Oregon is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to protecting and strengthening the health and well-being of Oregon's children and families. We work to inform decision makers, the media, and the general public about the issues impacting children and offer solutions that constitute sound policy choices and smart investments. One of our priorities is family financial stability. Without access to affordable quality child care, parents face significant barriers to obtaining and maintaining employment. Unfortunately, access to affordable quality child care is out of reach for many of Oregon's parents. In fact, in Oregon, 2 out of 3 families, 65% with incomes below the state median income, cannot find affordable child care, which we define as spending less than 10% of your income on child care. The cost of child care has risen over the last decade for all ages and all types of care, with family care provider and center care costs increasing 43% and 51% respectively. The employment-related daycare program, ERDC, increases the affordability of child care for low-income working families by reimbursing child care providers for a portion of the care of the costs of care after parents pay a copayment. In fiscal year 2003-2004, over 9,000 families affecting nearly 20,000 children were assisted by the program every month. We commend the Ways and Means co-chairs for restoring the cuts to employment-related daycare program proposed in the governor's recommended budget. The governor's proposed cuts would further weaken the program and would impact an additional 1,200 families per month. The income eligibility for ERDC was already reduced from 185% to 150% of the federal poverty level during the 2003 special session. The results of that were that more than 500 families lost access to affordable child care. Affordable, quality child care is also a bottom line issue for businesses, employers, and the state of Oregon's economic well-being. When employees don't have access to quality care for their children, we lose productivity, there's higher turnover, and reduced profits. With the economy improving and more parents returning to work, now is the time to strengthen rather than cut Oregon's child care system. I urge you to protect the employment-related daycare program from further cuts and, if possible, to restore the income eligibility to 105% of the federal poverty level. I have also provided you with a handout that outlines the public investments in early childhood care and education in Oregon. You'll note that the state's contribution is small, 6%. But federal dollars account for 22% of the total investment, and parent-paid tuition and fees account for the remaining 72%. I'm also submitting a statement on behalf of One Voice for Child Care.
Okay, thank you. And we will review the statements.
Thank you.
Okay, appreciate that. Cherie.
Yes. I'm here on for Independent Living Resources and Voc Rehab. Back in 1969, when I was in college, the Voc Rehab helped me with college tuition, books, readers, and so forth. I have a visual handicap, and I was pretty much a stay-at-home mom. And then my first husband committed suicide, and my children were 4 and 7. And I went back to Voc Rehab. I did have a teaching credential, and was going back to work. Or had been at work, and then after he died, I stayed home with the children, and then I got remarried about 5 years later, and started to pursue another career. Because of my visual handicap, I couldn't continue in the classroom, and again, VRC helped me. And at that time, they helped me with a restricted driver's license, so I learned how to drive at 35 for the first time. It's pretty exciting. VRC had helped me with putting together my own business, and I fell ill, and I went through a divorce. And now I'm back at VRC, and this time they are helping me again, and also along with Independent Living Resources, I'm volunteering there, and they're helping me to self-advocate for myself, and also there, I want to say something positive about Independent Living Resources, that they offer a really good support emotionally, mentally, physically. They have resources there that will help me in establishing my business. And I would just like to say that they are entitled just as much as VRC for services, for funds, excuse me. And I just thank you for hearing me today.
Thank you, all three of you, for coming in. If Denise Washington, Julia Lynch, and Michael Cross could come forward. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Denise Washington, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, known also as OCADSV. It was established in 1978. It's a statewide support network for the domestic violence and rape crisis centers in Oregon that are working to end domestic violence and sexual assault in our state. I want to talk to you about the temporary assistance to domestic violence survivors portion of the CAF budget today. And I want you to think about women who are in homes where they're not safe, where they're being beaten, where they're being raped, and there may be children in those homes. When those women make the decision that they're going to seek safety for themselves and for their children, oftentimes they will call a crisis line, they'll go to a shelter program, they'll receive needed services so that they are safe, they develop a safety plan, they know what their options are. But more is needed, and that's where this fund comes in. Oftentimes, when victims want to start over, they don't have resources. And without those resources, that new start would be impossible. One of the barriers to leaving an abusive relationship is economic. Being safe in leaving that abusive partner may require you to move, and it may require you to move to a different city. It may mean changing locks and other security measures. Oftentimes, women leave in the middle of the night with their kids and with their clothes on their back. And so when you think about the funds that it would take and the resources it would take to surmount those obstacles, they can be very large. And when you're dealing with the aftermath of abuse also. This is where the TADVS funds come in. They can be a critical support to ensure women's safety and to help women protect themselves and their children from further violence. To be eligible, a person has to either have a child or children or be pregnant. Only $1,200 is available, and payment is generally not made to the survivor, but it's made to the provider of a specific service, such as a landlord. The program is open for 90 days, and once again, the DHF people also create, along with the survivor, a safety plan. And the payments can be made to help support completion of that plan. We also know, unfortunately, that domestic violence can escalate after a woman has left the situation. Women can be beaten, they can be stalked, they can be raped. And unfortunately, this can be a time of the most lethality.
Okay. Thank you.
So what this program does is it allows survivors to access services more than once per year. If you want to look at it just purely in terms of economic benefits, if women aren't hurt, if children aren't hurt, they're not going to be accessing the medical system. They're not going to be accessing the law enforcement system. And they, if they get support during this transition period of crisis, then the hope is that they can become self-supporting. Okay. So this is a critical strategy, and I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you for your time and your testimony. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Julia Lynn, and I'm here to support the Disposed of Voc Rehab Division. I just want to say that I have been born with cerebral palsy. I've had it all my life, and I'm here to support the Voc Rehab and the Living Independently program. Without them, I don't know where I'd be today. I'm just here to support them, and they are wonderful people. Voc Rehab, and I started out, I came to Oregon about 12 years ago, and I started out trying to find a job on my own. I find that very difficult with a physical disability. So would Voc Weed have, when they came to help, I got a job offer at LIPA. So, and I just wanted to support them, and I really, I'm glad that they were there for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you very much for coming in and sharing that with us. Representative Hannah?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank
appreciate
you.
Both of you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Philip Kennedy Wong, Anthony Granados, and Michael Cross, if he's here.
I just want to say good morning to members of the committee, Chairman Richardson, members of the committee. This is Philip Kennedy Wong for Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. We are the Association of 17 Christian Denominations, and we're here to testify on behalf of the Children, Adult, and Families Division budget for NDHS. What you have before you in our submitted testimony are four programs that we have identified as critical programs that are targeted toward families that are in poverty or at the verge of homelessness. And we recognize that, the difficult position that you are in as decision makers in determining whether or not these programs will continue or to be cut. However, we want to express our trust in that your judgment will be based on the kind of interest that's what's best for those who are most vulnerable in the state of Oregon. I'd like to highlight four of these programs, and I'll try to keep my comments brief. I understand that the time is running short. The four program areas are the employment-related daycare. We do applaud the co-chairs for reinstating this program. There are some suggested changes that we have that are identified in our testimony. The second area is the Oregon Food Bank Network, and we ask that the state continues to fund the Oregon Food Bank Network, either increase it or at least maintain the minimum funding for it. The TANF program, which you have before you, it hasn't been adjusted for inflation since 1991, and as a result, the grant cash assistance to low-income families are not being as effective as they could be. And finally, a program that hasn't been included in either the governor's recommended budget or in the co-chair's budget is emergency assistance, and this is not to be confused with the domestic violence program in emergency assistance. This is a program that unfortunately was cut in 2003. It's a program that's targeted towards families on the verge of becoming homeless. We ask that for your consideration that this program be reinstated. It's a very critical program in preventing families from becoming homeless, and that we ask that this program be funded at a level prior to 2003. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Richardson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anthony Granados, representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. The Oregon Catholic Conference officially represents the Catholic bishops of Oregon in service to the more than 425,000 Roman Catholics for the common good of all in our state. I really cannot say enough how much I do not envy your position and these decisions you have to make. But as representative of the church, I'm here to offer you a moral voice and a moral insight and remind you that the decisions you make here during this legislative session are moral choices. They do have impact on people's lives, and as is seen here today from the people who have testified, there are serious needs that our citizens have that they require for a good life. And part of the Catholic tradition is seeking the common good, and the common good not only speaks to the spiritual, but also the physical benefits, the physical way of life that we as human beings deserve to live in order to have a good life. And we ask you to consider that in your deliberations. My good friend and brother here has talked about some of the very important programs which we, through the Oregon Catholic Conference, support. Specific, I'd like to mention the Emergency Assistance Program again, which was reduced in the governor's budget. The regular emergency assistance program provided, when it was funded, one-time payments to help families receiving TANF address financial crises. And this program, in a sense, acted effectively to prohibit people from becoming homeless. One of the goals of the program was to prevent, like I said, homelessness. The regular emergency assistance program was reduced in 2002 until its suspension and ultimate elimination as a result of ballot measure 30 in 2003. In addition to emergency assistance, we'd ask you to consider general assistance, which is similar to emergency assistance, but it affects families and individuals who have physical impairment. That is in the senior and people with disabilities section. Also, Oregon Project Independence, the assisted living facility reimbursement rates, we'd ask that those be maintained. So again, I really come here giving you encouragement and hoping that you will take these into consideration before leaving this building, that these are programs that our people in our state cannot live without. Thank you.
Thank you both. That concludes the numbers of people that we have signing. I'd like to invite Ed Johnson to step forward. If there's anyone that we've missed, please also come forward at this time.
The senators have four, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you very kindly, Mr. Chair. My name is Ed Johnson, Lincoln County. I'm one of those thousands of citizens that are very discouraged, very frustrated with DHS's misleading to the public and lies of how they save families. I turned in my medical file and all the evidence with general assistance. When I became disabled on the job, I was not entitled to general assistance, workman's comp, insurance benefits, or anything. I end up losing my family. DHS comes into my fiance and tells her that if you go press charges against this man, we'll make sure your house is paid, we'll make sure you have car insurance, we'll make sure you have food stamps. This is standard practice by DHS in this state. All right, there's hundreds of cases in this state of how this agency destroys family. This agency literally took away my constitutional rights of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. This agency acted against the Constitution of the state of Oregon and the United States. Their job is to keep families together, not sit there and entice them to destroy families. That's what just outrages me. I have watched it. I have dealt with hundreds of cases in this state myself, helping people get back their families and stuff like that. The Senate and the House is familiar for some of that work for the last 10 years I've done. Now they finally got me, and now they're trying to do it May 11th, 9 p.m. I get to go back to court dealing with my ex-girlfriend that I have no contact with, haven't had, just because she's losing her benefits. So I tell her, you got to file again. Now, this is a reality, and I invite people to come see the reality. Mine is not an isolated case. I'm turning in my medical evidence. I don't have medical coverage. It's hard for me to pay my pain pills. I have three discs lodged in my spinal cord, slowly killing me. Half of my neck is titanium, 4-3-6, 3-4. Disc is in the spinal cord, 6-7 is in the spinal cord. I have L4, 3-L3 in the spinal cord, and S1. T1 and 2 exploding in my back. I have all the medical evidence to prove this. This is on a job injury. All right, and because of that, I'm supposed to lose it. I'm supposed to lose my dignity. Then they talk about food. Well, I have a bill of 803. Hopefully I can get on the food in the Senate bill, subsistence fishery bill. Last year, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife closed the Oregon coast down fishing. Again, the state took away our constitutional rights to feed ourselves under the Constitution of the state of Oregon and the United States. Life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Without eating, there's no life. Okay, now I took away my rights to feed myself because now the state's telling me I shouldn't have dignity to feed myself. I'm supposed to go to the food share. I don't have the right to go in the woods or to fish off the land to feed myself. And I'm not the only person. And if we don't sit there and protect our futures for the next generation, are we going to say that we have some major disaster and nobody's going to be allowed to feed themselves? We're going to rely on some corporation with the permission through the government to feed us? I mean, this is the direction we're going. And I know I'm living it right now. And this is horrifying when I'm going through it. You know, I mean, my spine is going. Everybody knows it. My legs are going. Medical evidence is there. This is not a joke. I live in extreme, constant pain. Plus on it, I don't get medical coverage. I don't get pain pills paid. They're supposed to cover it through, Medicare or DHS and all this stuff. But I'm always denied all these services because I'm disabled. because I'm the one that's supposed to fall through the cracks, so this agency can come up to you and say, see, we need more money for all these people. Okay? Well, until we take a 30% cut of administration, put that money back into the disabled people so people have a right, instead of sitting there saying that we don't have this and that, you know, the disabled people, the real ones who need the service, are the ones that they set up here. DHS will come up and say we need more money for, and we're the ones deliberately set up to go through this crack. I have 15 years of evidence, letters, documentations I've turned in all through this House and Senate for the last 4 years. All the evidence speaks over my case. I'm not an isolated situation. And until the state does a job for the disabled and the elderly and our children, like they say, instead of sitting there separating and using kids to turn against their families to get information to generate jobs, this is a disgrace we have done to ourselves. When are we going to stop doing this to ourselves? I mean, I gave up believing in God when I lost my family and everything. But I realized something. With all the things I'm doing right now, if there is a God, God's got me here doing this for a reason, and hope people wake up and see the truth instead of quit wearing the blinders. Because there is, I'm still questioning if there is.
Ed, is this a copy for us?
Yes, sir.
Okay, would you bring that forward? Thank you very much for coming in today. With that, we'll be adjourned for the day.